5 minutes later, he was sitting up and rubbing the side of his head, where he had quite a large swelling. "Who the hell was that woman?" he said. "Why are we surrounded by squirrels, and what do they want?" "I've been pestered by squirrels all night," said Arthur. "They keep on trying to give me magazines and stuff." Ford frowned. "Really?" he said. "And bits of rag." Ford thought. "Oh," he said, "is this near where your ship crashed?" "Yes," said Arthur. He said it a little tightly. "That's probably it," said Ford. "Can happen. Ship's cabin robots get destroyed. The cybermines that control them survive and start infesting the local wildlife. Can turn a whole ecosystem into some kind of helpless thrashing service industry, handing out hot towels and drinks to passers-by. Should be a law against it. Probably is. Probably also a law against there being a law against it, so everybody can get nice and worked up. Hey-ho. What did you say?" "I said," said Arthur, "and the woman is my daughter." Ford stopped rubbing his head. "Say that one more time." "I said," said Arthur huffily, "the woman is my daughter." "I didn't know," said Ford, "that you had a daughter." "Well, there's probably a lot you don't know about me," said Arthur. "Come to mention it, there's probably a lot I don't know about me either." "Well, well, well," said Ford, "when did this happen?" "I'm not quite sure." "Oh, that sounds like more familiar territory," said Ford. "Is there a mother involved?"
"Trillion," said Arthur.
"Trillion? I didn't think that..."
"No. Look, it's a bit embarrassing."
"I remember she told me once she had a kid," said Ford, "but only sort of in passing. I'm in touch with her from time to time. Never seen her with the kid."
Arthur said nothing.
Ford started to feel the side of his head again in some bemusement. "Are you sure this was your daughter?" he said.
"Tell me what happened," said Arthur.
"Phew! Long story. I was coming to pick up this parcel I'd sent myself here, care of you." Well, what was all that about?" said Arthur.
"I think it may be something unimaginably dangerous."
"And you sent it to me?" protested Arthur.
"Safest place I could think of. I thought I could rely on you to be absolutely boring and not open it. Anyway, coming in at night, I couldn't find this village place. I was going by pretty basic information. I couldn't find any signal of any kind. I guess you don't have signals and stuff here."
"That's what I like about it," said Arthur.
"Then I did pick up a faint signal from your old copy of the guide, so I homed in on that, thinking that would take me to you. I found I'd landed in some kind of wood, couldn't figure out what was going on. I get out and then see this woman standing there. I go up to say hello, then suddenly see that she's got this thing."
"What thing?" said Arthur.
"The thing I sent you, the new guide, the bird thing. You were meant to keep it safe, you idiot, but this woman had the thing right there by her shoulder. I ran forward and she hit me with a rock."
"I see," said Arthur. "What did you do?"
"Well, I fell over, of course. I was very badly hurt. She and the bird started to make off towards my ship, and when I say my ship, I mean an RW6.
"A what?"
"An RW6, for Zark's sake. I've got this great relationship going now between my credit card and the guide's central computer. You would not believe that ship, Arthur. It's..."
"So an RW6 is a spaceship, then?"
"Yes, it's..."
"Oh, never mind.
Look, just get some kind of grip, will you, Arthur? Or at least get some kind of catalogue." At this point, I was very worried, and I think, I was down on my knees and breathing profusely. So I did the only thing I could think of, which was to beg. I said, "Please, for Zark's sake, don't take my ship, and don't leave me stranded in the middle of some primitive Zarking forest with no medical help and a head injury. I could be in serious trouble, and so could she."
"What did she say?"
"She hit me on the head with a rock again."
"I think I can confirm that that was my daughter."
"Ah, sweet kid."
"You have to get to know her," said Arthur.
"Oh, she eases up, does she?"
"No," said Arthur, "but you get a better sense of when to duck." Ford held his head and tried to see straight. The sky was beginning to lighten in the west, which is where the sun rose. Arthur didn't particularly want to see it. The last thing he wanted after a hellish night like this one was some blasted day coming along and barging about the place.
"What are you doing in a place like this, Arthur?" demanded Ford.
"Well," said Arthur, "making sandwiches, mostly."
"What?"
"I am, probably was, the sandwich maker for a small tribe. It was a bit embarrassing, really. When I first arrived, that is, when they rescued me from the wreckage of this super-high-technology spacecraft which had crashed on their planet, they were very nice to me, and I thought I should help them out a bit. You know, I'm an educated chap from a high-technology culture. I could show them a thing or two. And, of course, I couldn't. I haven't got the faintest idea, when it comes down to it, of how anything actually works. I don't mean, like, video recorders. I mean, nobody knows how to work those. I mean, just something like a pen or an artesian well or something. Not the foggiest. I couldn't help at all. One day I got glum and made myself a sandwich. That suddenly got them all excited. They'd never seen one before. It was just an idea that had never occurred to them, and I happened to quite like making sandwiches, so it all sort of developed from there."
"And you enjoyed that?" said Ford.
"Well, yes, I think I sort of did, really. Getting a good set of knives, you know, that sort of thing." You didn't, for instance, said Ford, find it mind-witheringly, explosively, astoundingly, blisteringly dull?
Well, no, not as such, not actually blisteringly.
Odd, I would, said Ford.
Well, I suppose we have a different outlook.
Yes.
Like the picker birds.
Ford had no idea what he was talking about and couldn't be bothered to ask. Instead, he said, so how the hell do we get out of this place?
Well, I think the simplest way from here is just to follow the way down the valley to the plains, probably take an hour, and then walk around from there. I don't think I could face going back up and over the way I came.
Walk around where from there?
Well, back to the village, I suppose.
Arthur sighed a little forlornly.
I don't want to go to any blasted village, snapped Ford. We've got to get out of here.
Where? How? Said Arthur.
I don't know. You tell me. You live here. There must be some way off this zarking planet.
I don't know, said Arthur. What do you usually do? Sit around and wait for a passing spacecraft, I suppose.
Oh, yes? And how many spacecraft have visited the zark-forsaken little flea pit recently?
Well, a few years ago there was mine that crashed here by mistake, then there was a trillion, then the parcel delivery, and now you, and...
Yes, but apart from the usual suspects...
Well, I think pretty much none, so far as I know. Pretty quiet around here. As if deliberately to prove him wrong, there was a long, low, distant roll of thunder. Ford leapt to his feet fretfully, and started pacing backwards and forwards in the feeble, painful light of the early dawn, which lay streaked across the sky as if someone had dragged a piece of liver across it.
"You don't understand how important this is," he said.
"What? You mean my daughter out there all alone in the galaxy? You think I don't?"
"Can we feel sorry for the galaxy later?" said Ford. "This is very, very serious indeed. The guide has been taken over. It's been bought out."
Arthur leapt up.
"Oh, very serious," he shouted. "Please fill me in straight away on some corporate publishing politics. I can't tell you how much has been on my mind of late."
"You don't understand," said Ford. "There's a whole new guide."
"Oh," shouted Arthur again. Oh, I'm incoherent with excitement. I can hardly wait for it to come out to find out which are the most exciting spaceports to get bored hanging about in some globular cluster I've never heard of. Please can we rush to a store that's got it right this very instant?"
Ford narrowed his eyes. "This is that thing you call sarcasm, isn't it?"
"Do you know," bellowed Arthur, "I think it is. I really think it might just be a crazy little thing called sarcasm seeping in at the edges of my manner of speech. Ford, I have had a fucking bad night. Will you please try and take that into account while you consider what fascinating bits of badger-sputingly inconsequential trivia to assail me with next?"
"Try to rest," said Ford. "I need to think."
"Why do you need to think? Can't we just sit and go with our lips for a bit? Couldn't we just dribble gently and loll a little bit to the left for a few minutes? I can't stand it, Ford. I can't stand all this thinking and trying to work things out anymore. You may think that I'm just standing here barking."
It hadn't occurred to me, in fact.
"But I mean it. What is the point? We assume that every time we do anything, we know what the consequences will be, i.e. more or less what we intend them to be. This is not only not always correct, it is wildly, crazily, stupidly, cross-eyed, blithering, insectly wrong."
"Which is exactly my point," said Ford.
"Thank you,"
said Arthur, sitting down again.
"What?"
"Temporal reverse engineering." Arthur put his head in his hands and shook it gently from side to side. "Is there any humane way," he moaned, "in which I can prevent you from telling me what temporary reverse bloody what's-itting is?" "No," said Ford, "because your daughter is caught up in the middle of it, and it is deadly, deadly serious." Thunder rolled in the pause. "All right," said Arthur, "tell me."
"I leapt out of a high-rise office window," said Ford.
This cheered Arthur up.
"Oh," he said, "why don't you do it again?"
"I did."
"Hmm,"
said Arthur, disappointed. "Obviously no good came of it."
"The first time," said Ford, "I managed to save myself by the most astonishing, and, I say this in all modesty, fabulous piece of ingenious, quick-thinking agility, fancy footwork and self-sacrifice."
"What was the self-sacrifice?" said Arthur.
"I jettisoned half of a much-loved and, I think, irreplaceable pair of shoes."
"Why was that self-sacrifice?"
"Because they were mine," said Ford crossly.
"I think we have different value systems," said Arthur.
"Well, mine's better," said Ford.
"Well, that's according to your..." "Oh, never mind. So having saved yourself very cleverly once, you very sensibly went and jumped again. Please don't tell me why. Just tell me what happened, if you must."
"I fell straight into the open cockpit of a passing jet town car, whose pilot had just accidentally pushed the eject button when he meant only to change tracks on the stereo. Now, even I couldn't think that that was particularly clever of me."
"Now, I don't know," said Arthur wearily. "I expect he probably sneaked into his jet car the previous night and set the pilot's least favourite track to play or something." No, I didn't, said Ford. Just checking. Though, oddly enough, somebody else did. And this is the nub. You could trace the chain and branches of crucial events and coincidences back and back. Turned out, the new guide had done it. That bird.
What bird? Said Arthur.
You haven't seen it?
No.
Oh, it's a lethal little thing. Looks pretty, talks big, collapses waveforms selectively at will.
What does that mean?
Temporal reverse engineering.
Oh, said Arthur. Oh, yes.
The question is, who is it really doing it for?
I've actually got a sandwich in my pocket, said Arthur Delving. Would you like a bit?
Yeah, okay. It's a bit squished and sodden, I'm afraid.
Never mind.
They munched for a bit.
It's quite good, in fact, said Ford. What's the meat in it?
Perfectly normal beast, said Arthur.
Ah, not come across that one.
So the question is, Ford continued, who is the bird really doing it for? What's the real game here?
Mmm,
et Arthur. When I found the bird, continued Ford, which I did by a series of coincidences that are interesting in themselves, it put on the most fantastic multidimensional display of pyrotechnics I've ever seen. It then said that it would put its services at my disposal in my universe. I said thanks, but no thanks. It said that it would do it anyway, whether I liked it or not. I said just try it, and it said that it would, and indeed already had done. I said we'd see about that, and it said that we would. That's when I decided to pack the thing up and get it out of there. So I sent it to you for safety.
Oh, yes, said Arthur. Whose?
Never you mind, said Ford. Then, what with one thing and another, I thought it prudent to jump out of the window again, being fresh out of other options at the time. Luckily for me, the jet car was there, otherwise I would have had to fall back on ingenious quick-thinking agility, maybe another shoe or, failing all else, the ground. But it meant that, whether I liked it or not, the guide was, well, working for me, and that was deeply worrying.
Why?
Because if you've got the guide, you think that you are the one it's working for. Everything went swimmingly smoothly for me from then on, up to the very moment that I came up against the totty with the rock. Then, bang, I'm history. I'm out of the loop.
Are you referring to my daughter?
As politely as I can, said Ford. She's the next one in the chain who will think that everything is going fabulously for her. She can beat whoever she likes around the head with bits of the landscape. Everything will just swim for her until she's done whatever she's supposed to do, and then it'll be all up for her too. It's reverse temporal engineering, and clearly nobody understood what was being unleashed.
Like me, for instance, said Arthur.
What? Oh, wake up, Arthur. Look, let me try it again. The new guide came out of the research labs. It made use of this new technology of unfiltered perception. Do you know what that means?
Look, I've been making sandwiches for Bob's sake, said Arthur.
Who's Bob?
Never mind, just carry on.
Unfiltered perception, said Ford, means it perceives everything. Got that? I don't perceive everything, you don't perceive everything, we have filters. The new guide doesn't have any sense filters, it perceives everything. It wasn't a complicated technological idea, it was just a question of leaving a bit out. Got it?
Why don't I just say that I've got it, said Arthur, and then you can carry on regardless.
Right. Now, because the bird can perceive every possible universe, it is present in every possible universe, yes?
Yes-ish.
So what happens is, the bozos in the marketing and accounting department say, oh, that sounds good. Doesn't that mean we only have to make one of them and then sell it an infinite number of times? Don't squint at me like that, Arthur. This is how accountants think.
Well, it's quite clever, isn't it?
No, it's fantastically stupid. Look, the machine's only a little guide. It's got some quite clever cyber technology in it, but because it has unfiltered perception, any smallest move it makes has the power of a virus. It can propagate throughout space, time, and a million other dimensions. Anything can be focused anywhere in any of the universes that you and I move in. Its power is recursive. Think of a computer program. Somewhere there is one key instruction, and everything else is just functions calling themselves, or brackets billowing out endlessly through an infinite address space. What happens when the brackets collapse? What's the final end if? Is any of this making sense, Arthur?
Sorry, I was nodding off for a moment. Something about the universe, yes?
Something about the universe, yes, said Ford wearily. He sat down again. All right, he said, think about this. You know who I think I saw at the guide offices? Vogons.
Ah, I see I've said a word you understand at last.
Arthur leapt to his feet. That noise, he said.
What noise?
The thunder.
What about it? It isn't thunder. It's the spring migration of the perfectly normal beasts. It started.
What are these animals you keep on about?
I don't keep on about them. I just put bits of them in sandwiches.
Why are they called perfectly normal beasts? Said Ford. Arthur told him. It wasn't often that Arthur had the pleasure of seeing Ford's eyes open wide with astonishment.
Chapter 19.
It was a sight that Arthur never quite got used to or tired of. He and Ford had tracked their way swiftly along the side of the small river that flowed down along the bed of the valley, and when at last they reached the margin of the plains, they pulled themselves up into the branches of a large tree to get a better view of one of the stranger and more wonderful visions that the galaxy has to offer. The great thunderous herd of thousand upon thousand of perfectly normal beasts was sweeping in magnificent array across the Anhondo plain. In the early pale light of the morning, as the great animals charged through the fine steam of the sweat of their bodies mingled with the muddy mist churned up by their pounding hooves, their appearance seemed a little unreal and ghostly anyway, but what was heart-stopping about them was where they came from and where they went to, which appeared to be simply nowhere. They formed a solid, charging phalanx, roughly 100 yards wide and 1/2 mile long. The phalanx never moved, except that it exhibited a slight gradual drift sideways and backwards for the 8 or 9 days that it regularly appeared for. But though the phalanx stayed more or less constant, the great beasts of which it was composed charged steadily at upwards of 20 miles an hour, appearing suddenly from thin air at one end of the plain and disappearing equally abruptly at the other end. No one knew where they came from. No one knew where they went. They were so important to the lives of the Lamuellans, it was almost as if nobody liked to ask. Old Thrashbark had said on one occasion that sometimes if you received an answer, the question might be taken away. Some of the villagers had privately said that this was the only properly wise thing that they'd ever heard Thrashbark say, and after a short debate on the matter, had put it down to chance. The noise of the pounding of the hooves was so intense that it was hard to hear anything else above it.
"What did you say?" shouted Arthur. "I said," shouted Ford, "this looks like it might be some kind of evidence of dimensional drift." "Which is what?" shouted Arthur back. "Well, a lot of people are beginning to worry that space-time is showing signs of cracking up with everything that's happening to it. There are quite a lot of worlds where you can see how the land masses have cracked up and moved around just from the weirdly long and meandering routes that migrating animals take. This might be something like that. We live in twisted times." Still, in the absence of a decent spaceport...
Arthur looked at him in a kind of frozen way.
"What do you mean?" he said. "What do you mean, what do I mean?" shouted Ford. "You know perfectly well what I mean. We're going to ride our way out of here."
"Are you seriously suggesting we try to ride a perfectly normal beast?"
"Yeah. See where it goes to."
"We'll be killed."
"No," said Arthur suddenly. "We won't be killed. At least I won't. Ford, have you ever heard of a planet called Stavromula Beta?"
Ford frowned.
"Don't think so," he said. He pulled out his own battered old copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and accessed it.
"Any funny spelling?" he said.
"Don't know," said Arthur. "I've only ever heard it said, and that was by someone who had a mouthful of other people's teeth. You remember I told you about Agrajag?"
Ford thought for a moment.
"You mean the guy who was convinced you were getting him killed over and over again?"
"Yes," said Arthur. "One of the places he claimed I'd got him killed was Stavromula Beta. Someone tries to shoot me, it seems. I duck, and Agrajag, or at least one of his many reincarnations, gets hit. It seems that this has definitely happened at some point in time, so I suppose I can't get killed at least until after I've ducked on Stavromula Beta. Only no one's ever heard of it."
"Hmm."
Ford tried a few other searches of The Hitchhiker's Guide, but drew a blank.
"Nothing," he said.
"Oh, well," said Arthur.
"I was just..."
No, I've never heard of it," said Ford finally.
He wondered why it was ringing a very, very faint bell, though.
"Okay," said Arthur. "I've seen the way the Lamuellan hunters trap perfectly normal beasts. If you spear one in the herd, it just gets trampled, so they have to lure them out one at a time for the kill. It's very like the way a matador works, you know, with a brightly coloured cape. You get one to charge at you and then step aside and execute a rather elegant swing through with the cape. Have you got anything like a brightly coloured cape about you?"
"This do," said Ford, handing him his towel.
Chapter 20. Leaping onto the back of a 1.5-ton perfectly normal beast migrating through your world at a thundering 20 miles an hour is not as easy as it might at first seem. Certainly it is not as easy as the Lamuel and Hunters had made it seem, and Arthur Dent was prepared to discover that this might turn out to be the difficult bit. What he hadn't been prepared to discover, however, was how difficult it was even getting to the difficult bit. It was the bit that was supposed to be the easy bit, which turned out to be practically impossible. They couldn't even catch the attention of a single animal. The perfectly normal beasts were so intent on working up a good thunder with their hooves, heads down, shoulders forward, back legs pounding the ground into porridge, that it would have taken something not merely startling but actually geological to disturb them. The sheer amount of thundering and pounding was, in the end, more than Arthur and Ford could deal with. After they had spent nearly 2 hours prancing about doing increasingly foolish things with a medium-sized, floral-patterned bath towel, they had not managed to get even one of the great beasts thundering and pounding past them to do so much as glance casually in their direction. They were within 3 feet of the horizontal avalanche of sweating bodies. To have been much closer would have been to risk instant death, chronologic or no chronologic. Arthur had seen what remained of any perfectly normal beast, which, as the result of a clumsy misthrow by a young and inexperienced Lamuel and Hunter, had got speared while still thundering and pounding with the herd. One stumble was all it took. No prior appointment with death on Stavromula Beta, wherever the hell Stavromula Beta was, would save you or anybody else from the thunderous, mangling pounding of those hooves. At last, Arthur and Ford staggered back. They sat down, exhausted and defeated, and started to criticise each other's technique with the towel. "You've got to flick it more," complained Ford. "You need more follow-through from the elbow if you're going to get those blasted creatures to notice anything at all." "Follow-through," protested Arthur. "You need more suppleness in the wrist." "You need more after-flourish," countered Ford. "You need a bigger towel."
"You need," said another voice, "a picker bird."
"You what?" The voice had come from behind them. They turned, and there, standing behind them in the early morning sun, was old Thrashbarg.
"To attract the attention of a perfectly normal beast," he sissily walked forward towards them, "you need a picker bird, like this."
From under the rough, cassocky robe-like thing he wore, he drew a small picker bird. It sat restlessly on old Thrashbarg's hand and peered intently at Bob knows what, darting around about 3 feet 6 inches in front of it. Ford instantly went into the sort of alert crouch he liked to do when he wasn't quite sure what was going on or what he ought to do about it. He waved his arms around very slowly in what he hoped was an ominous manner. "Who is this?" he hissed. "It's just old Thrashbarg," said Arthur quietly, "and I wouldn't bother with all the fancy movements. He's just as experienced a bluffer as you are. You could end up dancing around each other all day." "The bird," hissed Ford again. "What's the bird?"
"It's just a bird," said Arthur impatiently. "It's like any other bird. It lays eggs and goes ark at things you can't see, or car or writ or something."
"Have you seen one lay eggs?" said Ford suspiciously.
"For heaven's sake, of course I have," said Arthur. "I've eaten hundreds of them. Make rather a good omelette. The secret is little cubes of cold butter and then whipping it lightly with—"
"I don't want a zarking recipe," said Ford. "I just want to be sure it's real. It's a real bird and not some kind of multidimensional cyber nightmare."
He slowly stood up from his crouched position and started to brush himself down. He was still watching the bird, though. "So," said old Thrashbarg to Arthur, "is it written that Bob shall once more take back unto himself the benediction of his once-given sandwich-maker?" Ford almost went back into his crouch.
"It's all right," muttered Arthur. "He always talks like that."
Aloud, he said, "Ah, venerable Thrashbarg, I'm afraid I think I'm going to have to be popping off now, but young Drimple, my apprentice, will be a fine sandwich-maker in my stead. He has the aptitude, a deep love of sandwiches, and the skills he has acquired so far, though rudimentary as yet, will in time mature and, I think he'll work out okay, is what I'm trying to say."
Old Thrashbarg regarded him gravely. His old grey eyes moved sadly. He held his arms aloft, one still carrying a bobbing picker bird, the other his staff.
"O sandwich maker from Bob," he pronounced.
He paused, furrowed his brow, and sighed as he closed his eyes in pious contemplation.
"Life," he said, "will be a very great deal less weird without you."
Arthur was stunned. "Do you know," he said, "I think that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me." "Can we get on, please?" said Ford. Something was already happening. The presence of the picker bird at the end of Thrashbarg's outstretched arm was sending tremors of interest through the thundering herd. The odd head flicked momentarily in their direction. Arthur began to remember some of the perfectly normal beast hunts he had witnessed. He recalled that as well as the hunter matadors brandishing their capes, there were always others standing behind them holding picker birds. He had always assumed that, like him, they had just come along to watch. Old Thrashbarg moved forward, a little closer to the rolling herd. Some of the beasts were now tossing their heads back with interest at the sight of the picker bird. Old Thrashbarg's outstretched arms were trembling. Only the pickerbird itself seemed to show no interest in what was going on. A few anonymous molecules of air, nowhere in particular, engaged all of its perky attention.
"Now," exclaimed Old Thrashbarg at last, "now you may work them with the towel."
Arthur advanced with Ford's towel, moving the way the hunter matadors did, with a kind of elegant strut that did not come at all naturally to him. But now he knew what to do and that it was right. He brandished and flicked the towel a few times to be ready for the moment, and then he watched. Some distance away, he spotted the beast he wanted. Head down, it was galloping towards him right on the very edge of the herd. Old Thrashbarg twitched the bird. The beast looked up, tossed its head, and then, just as its head was coming down again, Arthur flourished the towel in the beast's line of sight. It tossed its head again in bemusement, and its eyes followed the movement of the towel. He had got the beast's attention. From that moment on, it seemed the most natural thing to coax and draw the animal towards him. Its head was up, cocked slightly to one side. It was slowing to a canter, and then a trot. A few seconds later, the huge thing was standing there amongst them, snorting, panting, sweating, and sniffing excitedly at the pickerbird, which appeared not to have noticed its arrival at all. With strange sort of sweeping movements of his arms, Old Thrashbarg kept the pickerbird in front of the beast, but always out of its reach and always downwards. With strange sort of sweeping movements of the towel, Arthur kept drawing the beast's attention this way and that, always downward. "I don't think I've ever seen anything quite so stupid in my life," muttered Ford to himself. At last the beast dropped, bemused but docile, to its knees.
"Go," whispered Old Thrashbarg urgently to Ford. "Go, go now."
Ford leapt up onto the great creature's back, scrabbling amongst its thick knotty fur for purchase, grasping great handsful of the stuff to hold him steady once he was in position.
"Now, sandwich maker, go."
He performed some elaborate sign and ritual handshake, which Arthur couldn't quite get the hang of, because Old Thrashbarg had obviously made it up on the spur of the moment. Then he pushed Arthur forward. Taking a deep breath, he clambered up behind Ford, onto the great, hot, heaving back of the beast, and held on tight. Huge muscles the size of sea lions rippled and flexed beneath him. Old Thrashbarg held the bird suddenly aloft. The beast's head swiveled up to follow it. Thrashbarg pushed upwards and upwards repeatedly with his arms and with the pickerbird, and slowly, heavily, the perfectly normal beast lurched up off its knees and stood at last swaying slightly. Its two riders held on fiercely and nervously. Arthur gazed out over the sea of hurtling animals, straining in an attempt to see where it was they were going, but there was nothing but heat haze. "Can you see anything?" he said to Ford. "No." Ford twisted round to glance back, trying to see if there was any clue as to where they had come from. Still, nothing. Arthur shouted down at Thrashbarg.
"Do you know where they come from?" he called, "or where they're going?" "The domain of the king," shouted Old Thrashbarg back.
"King?" shouted Arthur in surprise. "What king?" The perfectly normal beast was swaying and rocking restlessly under him.
"What do you mean, what king?" shouted Old Thrashbarg. "The king!"
"It's just that you never mentioned a king," shouted Arthur back in some consternation.
"What?"
shouted Old Thrashbarg. The thrumming of a thousand hooves was very hard to hear over, and the old man was concentrating on what he was doing. Still holding the bird aloft, he led the beast slowly round till it was once more parallel with the motion of its great herd. He moved forward. The beast followed. He moved forward again. The beast followed again. At last, the beast was lumbering forward with a little momentum.
"I said you never mentioned a king," shouted Arthur again. "I didn't say a king," shouted Old Thrashbarg. "I said the king."
He drew back his arm and then hurled it forward with all his strength, casting the pickerbird up into the air above the herd. This seemed to catch the pickerbird completely by surprise, as it had obviously not been paying any attention at all to what was going on. It took it a moment or two to work out what was happening. Then it unfurled its little wings, spread them out, and flew.
"Go!" shouted Thrashbarg. "Go and meet your destiny, sandwich maker!"
Arthur wasn't so sure about wanting to meet his destiny as such. He just wanted to get to wherever it was they were going so he could get back off this creature again. He didn't feel at all safe up there. The beast was gathering speed as it followed in the wake of the pickerbird. And then it was in at the fringes of the great tide of animals. And in a moment or two, with its head down, the pickerbird forgotten, it was running with the herd again and rapidly approaching the point at which the herd was vanishing into thin air.
Arthur and Ford held on to the great monster for dear life, surrounded on all sides by hurtling mountains of bodies. "Go, ride that beast!" shouted Thrashbarg. His distant voice reverberated in their ears. "Ride that perfectly normal beast! Ride it! Ride it!" Ford shouted in Arthur's ear. "Where did he say we were going?" "He said something about a king," shouted Arthur in return, holding on desperately. "What king?" "That's what I said. He just said the king." "I didn't know there was a the king," shouted Ford. "Nor did I," shouted Arthur back. "Well, except, of course, for the king," shouted Ford. "I don't suppose he meant him." "What king?" shouted Arthur. The point of exit was almost upon them. Just ahead of them, perfectly normal beasts were galloping into nothingness and vanishing. "What do you mean, what king?" shouted Ford. "I don't know what king. I'm only saying that he couldn't possibly mean the king, so I don't know what he means." "Ford, I don't know what you're talking about." "So?" said Ford. Then with a sudden rush, the stars came on, turned and twisted round their heads, and then just as suddenly turned off again. Chapter 21. Misty grey buildings loomed and flickered. They bounced up and down in a highly embarrassing way. What sort of buildings were they? What were they for? What did they remind her of? It's so difficult to know what things are supposed to be when you suddenly turn up unexpectedly on a different world which has a different culture, a different set of the most basic assumptions about life, and also incredibly dull and meaningless architecture. The sky above the buildings was a hostile and cold black. The stars, which should have been blindingly brilliant points of light this far from the sun, were blurred and dulled by the thickness of the huge shielding bubble. Perspex or something like it. Something dull and heavy, anyway. Tricia wound the tape back again to the beginning. She knew there was something slightly odd about it. Well, in fact, there were about a million things that were slightly odd about it, but there was one thing that was nagging at her, and she hadn't quite got it. She sighed and yawned. As she waited for the tape to rewind, she cleared away some of the dirty polystyrene coffee cups that had accumulated on the editing desk and tipped them into the bin. She was sitting in a small editing suite at a video production company in Soho. She had Do Not Disturb notices plastered all over the door and a block on all incoming calls at the switchboard. This was originally to protect her astonishing scoop, but now it was to protect her from embarrassment. She would watch the tape all the way through again from the beginning. If she could bear to, she might do some fast-forwarding here and there. It was about 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon, and she had a kind of sick feeling. She was trying to work out what the cause of this slightly sick feeling was, and there was no shortage of candidates. First of all, it had all come on top of the overnight flight from New York. The red eye, always a killer, that. Then, being accosted by aliens on her lawn and flown to the planet Rupert. She was not sufficiently experienced in that sort of thing to be able to say for sure that that was always a killer, but she would be prepared to bet that those who went through it regularly cursed it. There were always stress charts being published in magazines, 50 stress points for losing your job, 75 points for a divorce or changing your hairstyle and so on. None of them ever mentioned being accosted on your lawn by aliens and then being flown to the planet Rupert, but she was sure it was worth a few dozen points. It wasn't that the journey had been particularly stressful. It had been extremely dull, in fact. Certainly it had been no more stressful than the trip she had just taken across the Atlantic, and it had taken roughly the same time, about 7 hours. Well, that was pretty astounding, wasn't it? Flying to the outer limits of the solar system in the same time that it took to fly from New York meant they must have some fantastic, unheard-of form of propulsion in the ship. She quizzed her hosts about it, and they agreed that it was pretty good. "But how does it work?" she had demanded excitedly. She was still quite excited at the beginning of the trip. She found that part of the tape and played it through to herself. The Grebulons, which is what they called themselves, were politely showing her which buttons they pressed to make the ship go. "Yes, but what principle does it work on?" she heard herself demand from behind the camera. "Oh, you mean, is it something like a warp drive or something like that?" they said. "Yes," persisted Tricia, "what is it?" "It probably is something of the kind," they said. "Like what?" "Warp drive, photon drive, something like that. You'd have to ask the flight engineer." "Which one is he?" "We don't know. We have all lost our minds, you see." "Oh, yes," said Tricia, a little faintly. "So you said. How did you lose your minds exactly, then?" "We don't know," they said patiently. "Because you've lost your minds," echoed Tricia glumly. "Would you like to watch television? It is a long flight. We watch television. It is something we enjoy." All of this riveting stuff was on the tape, and fine viewing it made. First of all, the picture quality was extremely poor. Tricia didn't know why this was, exactly. She had a feeling that the Grebulons responded to a slightly different range of light frequencies, and that there had been a lot of ultraviolet around, which was mucking up the video camera. There were a lot of interference patterns and video snow as well, probably something to do with the warp drive that none of them knew the first thing about. So what she had on tape, essentially, was a bunch of slightly thin and discoloured people sitting around watching televisions that were showing network broadcasts. She had also pointed the camera out of the very tiny viewport near her seat, and got a nice, slightly streaky effect of stars. She knew it was real, but it would have taken a good 3 or 4 minutes to fake. In the end, she had decided to save her precious videotape for Rupert itself, and had simply sat back and watched television with them. She even dozed off for a while. So, part of her sick feeling came from the sense that she had had all that time in an alien spacecraft of astounding technological design, and had spent most of it dozing in front of reruns of MASH and Cagney and Lacey. But what else was there to do? She had taken some photos as well, of course, all of which had subsequently turned out to be badly fogged when she got them back from the chemist. Another part of her sick feeling probably came from the landing on Rupert. This, at least, had been dramatic and hair-raising. The ship had come sweeping in over a dark and sombre landscape, a terrain so desperately far removed from the heat and light of its parent sun, Sol, that it seemed like a map of the psychological scars of the mind of an abandoned child. Lights blazed through the frozen darkness and guided the ship into the mouth of some kind of cave that seemed to bend itself open to accept the small craft. Unfortunately, because of the angle of their approach and the depth at which the small, thick viewport was set into the craft's skin, it hadn't been possible to get the video camera to point directly at any of it. She ran through that bit of the tape. The camera was pointing directly at the sun. This is normally very bad for a video camera, but when the sun is roughly a third of a billion miles away, it doesn't do any harm. In fact, it hardly makes any impression at all. You just get a small point of light right in the middle of the frame, which could be just about anything. It was just one star in a multitude. Tricia fast-forwarded. Ah, now the next bit had been quite promising. They had emerged out of the ship into a vast grey hangar-like structure. This was clearly alien technology on a dramatic scale. Huge grey buildings under the dark canopy of the Perspex bubble. These were the same buildings that she had been looking at the end of the tape. She had taken more footage of them while leaving Rupert a few hours later, just as she was about to re-board the spacecraft for the journey home. What did they remind her of? Well, as much as anything else, they reminded her of a film set from just about any low-budget science fiction movie of the last 20 years. A lot larger, of course, but it all looked thoroughly tawdry and unconvincing on the video screen. Apart from the dreadful picture quality, she had been struggling with the unexpected effects of gravity that was appreciably lower than that on Earth, and she had found it very hard to keep the camera from bouncing around in an embarrassingly unprofessional way. It was therefore impossible to make out any detail. And now, here was the leader coming forward to greet her, smiling and sticking his hand out. That was what he was called, the leader. None of the Grebulons had names, largely because they couldn't think of any. Tricia discovered that some of them had thought of calling themselves after characters from television programs they had picked up from Earth, but hard as they had tried to call each other Wayne and Bobby and Chuck, some remnant of something lurking deep in the cultural subconscious they had brought with them from the distant stars, which were their home, must have told them that this really wasn't right and wouldn't do. The leader had looked pretty much like all the others, possibly a little less thin. He said how much she enjoyed her shows on TV, that he was her greatest fan, how glad he was that she'd been able to come along and visit them on Rupert, and how much everybody had been looking forward to her coming, how he hoped the flight had been comfortable, and so on. There was no particular sense she could detect of being any kind of emissary from the stars or anything. Certainly, watching it now on videotape, he just looked like some guy in costume and makeup standing in front of a set that wouldn't hold up too well if you leant against it. She sat staring at the screen with her face cradled in her hands and shaking her head in slow bewilderment. This was awful. Not only was this bit awful, but she knew what was coming next. It was the bit where the leader asked if she was hungry after the flight, and would she perhaps like to come and have something to eat. They could discuss things over a little dinner. She could remember what she was thinking at this point. Alien food. How was she going to deal with it? Would she actually have to eat it? Would she have access to some sort of paper napkin she could spit stuff out into? Wouldn't there be all sorts of differential immunity problems?
It turned out to be hamburgers. Not only did it turn out to be hamburgers, but the hamburgers it turned out to be were very clearly and obviously McDonald's hamburgers, which had been reheated in a microwave. It wasn't just the look of them, it wasn't just the smell. It was the polystyrene clamshell packages they came in, which had McDonald's printed all over them. "Eat, enjoy," said the leader. "Nothing is too good for our honoured guest." This was in his private apartment. Tricia looked around it in bewilderment that had bordered on fear, but had nevertheless got it all on videotape. The apartment had a waterbed in it, and a MIDI hi-fi, and one of those tall electrically illuminated glass things which sit on tabletops and appear to have large globules of sperm floating about in them. The walls were covered in velvet. The leader lounged against a brown corduroy beanbag and squirted breath freshener into his mouth. Tricia began to feel very scared suddenly. She was further from Earth than any human being, to her knowledge, had ever been, and she was with an alien creature who was lounging against a brown corduroy beanbag and squirting breath freshener into his mouth. She didn't want to make any false moves. She didn't want to alarm him, but there were things she had to know. Where did you get this? She asked, gesturing around the room nervously. The decor? Asked the leader. Do you like it? It is very sophisticated. We are a sophisticated people, we Grebulons. We buy sophisticated consumer durables by mail order. Tricia had nodded tremendously slowly at this point. Mail order, she had said. The leader chuckled. It was one of those dark chocolate, reassuring, silky chuckles. I think you think they ship it here. No, ha ha ha. We have arranged a special box number in New Hampshire. We make regular pickup visits. Ha ha. He lounged back in a relaxed fashion on his beanbag, reached for a reheated French fry and nibbled the end off it, an amused smile playing across his lips. Tricia could feel her brain beginning to bubble very slightly. She kept the video camera going. How do you pay for these wonderful, things? The leader chuckled again. American Express, he said, with a nonchalant shrug. Tricia nodded slowly this time. She knew that they gave cards exclusively to just about anybody. And these? She said, holding up the hamburger he had presented her with. It is very easy, said the leader. We stand in line. Again, Tricia realized with a cold, trickling feeling going down her spine. That explained an awful lot. She hit the fast-forward button again. There was nothing of any use here at all. It was all nightmarish madness. She could have faked something that would have looked more convincing. Another sick feeling began to creep over her as she watched this hopeless, awful tape, and she began with slow horror to realize that it must be the answer. She must be... She shook her head and tried to get a grip. An overnight flight going east, the sleeping pills she'd taken to get her through it, the vodka she'd had to set the sleeping pills going. What else? Well, there were 17 years of obsession that a glamorous man with two heads, one of which was disguised as a parrot in a cage, had tried to pick her up at a party, but had then impatiently flown off to another planet in a flying saucer. There suddenly seemed to be all sorts of bothersome aspects to that idea that had never really occurred to her. Never occurred to her. In 17 years. She stuffed her fist into her mouth. She must get help. Then there had been Eric Bartlett banging on about alien spacecraft landing on her lawn. And before that, New York had been, well, very hot and stressful. The high hopes and the bitter disappointment, the astrology stuff. She must have had a nervous breakdown. That was it. She was exhausted and she had had a nervous breakdown and had started hallucinating sometime after she got home. She had dreamt the whole story. An alien race of people dispossessed of their own lives and histories, stuck on a remote outpost of our solar system, and filling their cultural vacuum with our cultural junk. Ha! It was nature's way of telling her to check into an expensive medical establishment very quickly. She was very, very sick. She looked at how many large coughs she'd got through as well, and realized how heavily she was breathing and how fast. Part of solving any problem, she told herself, was realizing that you had it. She started to bring her breathing under control. She had caught herself in time. She had seen where she was. She was on the way back from whatever psychological precipice she had been on the brink of. She started to calm down, to calm down, to calm down. She sat back in the chair and closed her eyes. After a while, now that she was breathing normally again, she opened them again. So where had she got this tape from, then? It was still running. All right, it was a fake. She had faked it herself, that was it. It must have been her who had faked it, because her voice was all over the soundtrack, asking questions. Every now and then the camera would swing down at the end of a shot, and she would see her own feet in her own shoes. She had faked it, and she had no recollection of faking it, or any idea of why she had done it. Her breathing was getting hectic again as she watched the snowy, flickering screen. She must still be hallucinating. She shook her head, trying to make it go away. She had no memory of faking any of this very obviously fake stuff. On the other hand, she did seem to have memories that were very like the fake stuff. She continued to watch in a bewildered trance. End of side 7.